Once upon a time, there was a tyrannical husband who demanded his wife conform to rigid standards of his choosing. She was to do certain things for him as a wife, mother, and homemaker. In time, she came to hate her husband as much as she hated his list of rules and regulations. Then one day he died, mercifully as far as she was concerned. Some time later, she fell in love with another man and lived on a perpetual honeymoon. Her husband was committed to her and to her interests. Joyfully, she devoted herself to his happiness and welfare. One day, she came across one of the lists of do's and don'ts that her first husband had given to her. To her amazement, she found that she was doing for her second husband all of the things that her first husband demanded of her, although her second husband had never once suggested them. She did them as an expression of her love for him and her desire to please him. He had won her by his demonstration of selfless love. That account was compiled by James Hewitt in his book on Unlimited Illustrations. Now, so many times God asks man to do something and he'll do the opposite. No, think not that I come to destroy the law and people. And, of course, Christ came to fulfill it. Don't go after other gods. People do. Keep the holy days. Man doesn't. Don't try to determine the hour and the day of Christ's coming. People try to come up with that. Be fruitful and multiply. Instead, this nation is absorbed with abortion and zero-based growth. But one thing that man does that he's excited about, that God also is with the institution of marriage. God wants people to be happily married. And he institutes that in the beginning of his instruction to Adam and to Eve. But yet, one thing that is a mystery to this world is that marriage is governed by spiritual principles. Over in Jeremiah 10, verse 23, is a statement to that effect. And it applies in so many different activities of life, but it also includes marriage. In Jeremiah chapter 10, we see in verse 23 an amazing and a frank admission of the state of human beings, that man is incomplete without God. Jeremiah wrote here in verse 23, O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man to walk and direct into his steps. O Lord, correct me, but with judgment, not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. But Jeremiah was inspired to write that he realized that without God he was missing something. There was a missing dimension in his life, a spiritual dimension. Well, that spiritual dimension definitely governs marriage. And it's hard to imagine a marriage to be successful without the principles of God. But to be a complete success, marriage should be not just reasonably good or okay, but a wonderfully successful, a haven of happiness at which everybody on earth has secretly hoped for at one time or another. The point that I'd like to stress today is that you and I can and should have a wonderful marriage. A wonderful marriage. And we're entitled to that opportunity. Now it's up to us to apply it. Up to us to remember, to be aware of some of the things that maybe we overlook as we get caught up in day-to-day activity or we find ourselves responding to circumstance, environment, and how other people treat us. It's up to us. It's up to us to understand that you and I can have a wonderful marriage. Many here are married. Many others may marry in the future. But single or married, this topic helps us to be better Christians, better servants of Christ, because the same things that apply in the family that we have also applies within the family of the church. And it does fortify and build society. So it is a very, very important and significant topic. A mystery to the world is that marriage is not a 50-50 proposition. It is not a 50-50 proposition. I've heard some people say, well, in my family it is. You know, I do my part, my partner does his or her part. That is fine if both are in equal health, that are energetic, they're able to do. I recall one family, one couple that is, out west that I got to know, and she was saying one time when he was going through quite a bit of illness, and they were both in their 70s, and some people said, well, how are you able to do this and take care of him and so forth? And she said, well, I'm just paying George back for all the goodness that he helped me when I was younger and got me through a lot of difficult situations. I know that because of the challenges of marriage, I mean, that confront marriage, and this is not God's society, it's Satan's society with a lot of wrong influences. It's even Paul Harvey would take the time to cite the fact that there'd be certain people that, on the Tournament of Roses, he said, that have reached 50 years or 55 years of marriage. Well, I know that we've got some people in this room that have done that. How many people say have been married for 40 years? Raise of hand. A lot of people. And then how many for 50? Look at that. That's significant. You could be on national radio, or if this had happened when Paul Harvey was alive, was going on. Anybody for 55? That's phenomenal. 60? But anyway, yeah. We've got a person over here. Now, there's a lot of wisdom wrapped up in those examples. Those are fantastic examples that belong in a congregation. That's wonderful. Let me ask, how many of you that raised your hands never had a single challenge, or I rest my case, they didn't even get the hands up. Everybody knows. Life is not always the bed of roses, perhaps, but the way we approach it can make or break us. There have been people that have talked about going through the depression years and the others where they had to overlook some difficult things and work together. But we've got people here that have successfully done that. You can't do that unless you're dedicated, unless you're happy. And so that counts for a lot. That counts for a lot. And there are other people that are equally committed. Maybe circumstances changed. They've been remarried. And they are invested in those principles. And I think it's important to give credit where credit is due on that. It's a lot different than the way some in society view things. In one marriage ceremony, the minister was asking the groom the seven questions. Do you take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife, in sickness and health, for richer or for poorer, for better or for worse? Seven questions. And so he asked the groom, do you take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? That was question number one. And then two, in sickness, three, in health. And his answer was, yes, no, yes, yes, no, yes, no. Well, they almost froze the ceremony right then. And maybe they should have, because that is so conditional. It's so conditional, extremely conditional. The implication is, if I got my fair share out of it, count me in. But if not, the message of society is, well, if you had a 50-50 relationship and one's reneging, then it becomes a 40-50 relationship. Then I'll pull back my 50 and it'll be a 40-40. And then it gets to 30-30. And then it can get lower and lower. And then one or both parties feels cheated. And then friends and family and psychologists many times will say, you're not getting enough out of the relationship. You got to get out now. But in our church ceremony, it says, in sickness and health, for better, for worse, all the way through. There are no conditions in that. Why didn't God then create men and women to be the same? Because wouldn't it be easier if we all thought exactly the same way, derived the same conclusions? Because there are differences between men and women. And sometimes that can be perplexing. It doesn't have to be. Why is it that men and women are different? And they are, and we all know that. And God has brought them together in a marriage. Well, it forces us to look past ourselves. It forces us to be less selfish. It forces us to be more giving. Because a relationship like that can only prosper if we are going all out for each other. sometimes, and what is so common is that people will go out a little bit. And so you have a relationship, but it could be way more than that. It really could. The union of two people can bring in more talents, more understandings, and more abilities into the single relationship. For example, a single man can know how to change the oil of a car, paint a house, or build a garage. A single woman may learn to sew, learn to cook, be able to discern moods and children in a way that men typically miss. If you have the two get married, the overall relationship is that between the two of them, they can cover an oil change, painting a house, building a barn, sewing, cooking, and discerning attitude. So the relationship is stronger when you have all assets brought together. So that can be a blessing. It is a mystery how that can sometimes play out. In Ephesians chapter 5, Ephesians 5 discusses marriage, and I'd like to focus on verse 31 and verse 32. Ephesians chapter 5. Here it says, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and be joined unto his wife, and the two shall be one flesh." This is a great mystery, says Paul. But I speak concerning Christ and the church. And he goes on to say, "Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself, and his wife see that she honor, reverence her husband." Why is mystery a word that is chosen here? That is, I think, because the laws of God that govern marriage are invisibles to people that are not close to God, not employing the principles of God. I can recall Con Cathwood in his many years of marriage counseling saying that the bottom line with the marriage counseling in his experience was one common theme. The theme was that the woman had this, "I don't care what he asks me, I'm not doing what he wants." And the husband on the other side of the coin is totally self-absorbed. And there's this uneasy status quo. Marriage can, like a leaking of a tire, get to that point, but it doesn't have to. The natural result of having a conditional marriage is, let's say the woman says, "Well, why should I do for him when he insufficiently cares for me?" The man reciprocates, "Well, why should I do for her when she turns into my critic?" The woman says, "Well, if he loved me, I wouldn't belittle him." The man says, "Well, if she really loved me, I would be more inspired to do for her. I wouldn't be criticized." The woman could respond, "Well, I'm open for change, but he has to give in first." The man says, "I'm willing to change, but what if it's one-sided? Do I give up what little I think I have left?" Marriage is not about getting what you want. It's giving what is helpful. And when the two are convinced of that, then both will receive what they would like. That is a mystery because it doesn't seem to make sense on paper. Because giving, people view as, well, that's giving up, and I'm losing, and I'm risking being at a loss. I'm going to have to give up my time, my independence, my identity, my freedom, my money, whatever it is. It's going to be different things for different people. So that's not necessarily the way it works, but it's the way it seems to work. So to the carnal mind, subtraction subtracts. You're taking away. If you're giving, you're giving up. That's the mindset of human beings without God's Spirit strongly involved. Whereas what we understand is the way of give is better than the way of get, and when we are convicted of giving and giving, even if we don't immediately receive what we would like to have, that there is an incredible miracle that happens, that a relationship is strengthened, and the people that benefit, eventually both, think, "Wow, this is good. I want to continue this." And the more people give, the more they get back. Is it not true, Galatians 6, verse 7, what we sow is what we reap? In human dynamics, it may not be immediate, although sometimes it can be. And so let's go back to chapter 5 of Ephesians in verse 25. Here it says, "Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church, and he gave himself for it." He died for his church, for us. That's supreme love. That's more than just, "Oh, I think I like these people. I think I'll be their Lord," said Christ. No, he didn't do it that way. He gave his life. And men need to be willing to give their lives for their wives. Are you willing to run into a burning building to save her life? Are you willing to give her what you have, assuming she can manage it? Are you willing to help her when she's tired, i.e. wash the dishes, mop the floor, sweep the driveway, help in the laundry with the children? Are you willing to understand and to support emotional needs? A lot of times men don't mean to be bad, but they don't know, forget that women are different than they are. They think and process information differently. It's a good for us to occasionally be reminded of that. A woman wants a man that she can look up to, but not one that's going to look down on her. If men would give themselves for their wives the way Christ did for the church, then women liberation would die. Would die. D-I-E. Crash. I remember when I went to University of Vermont, we had there was always a protest against something. Get Vermont out of the United States, or get the U.S. out of the United Nations. Another one was about women's liberation. They had a new women's center on campus, and the siren call was, "Come learn about oil changes. Come, you know, rap about car mechanics. And, you know, we don't need men. We can do this on our own. We can be independent." And I imagine the people that had that perhaps had overbearing uncles, fathers, and maybe husbands. I don't know. But at the bottom of it, the flyer that went out was, "All power to the sisters." That's right. If men would give themselves to their wives, that would never, ever happen. The old adage is true. If a husband treats his wife like a thoroughbred, she will not turn into an old nag. Or better yet, treat his wife like royalty. If she knows that she is special to him, then he will be special to her. I will repeat what a quote from last week from Dr. Laura Schlesinger, and I think this is quite significant. One man had responded on her radio program, said, "We men are not dum-dums. We're not psychic readers, mind readers, and we're not one bit unromantic. We only need clear communication, appreciation, honest love, and respect." And he said, "This will be repaid by laying the moon and stars at your feet for your pleasure. There's no need to work on a man to get what you want. We live to take care of a wife, a family, and a home." Now, if I were nagged to pieces, and I'm not, it would be much more difficult for me to move heaven and earth. I might move a few pebbles. I think all of us are that way. I think all of us, if we've ever had a work for a boss who is domineering, unappreciative, critical, we probably couldn't wait till quitting time. Couldn't wait to get out of the circumstance, the situation. That's just natural. It's in our opportunity, our power, our position for each other to provide just the opposite climate, to show appreciation, words of kindness, words of love, and back it up with acts, because action is stronger than just words alone. But when we consider what true Christianity is, we're to share and to reach out and to give to other people in our sphere of influence, our sphere of activity. And that would certainly include our families. And I think that in many ways that a number of people here set phenomenal examples of a family dedication, of enhancement of the welfare of the next generation, and so on. We can build on these things and expand and it be pervasive to the entire congregation and hopefully one day in the world tomorrow to all of society, where we'll have a happy human race, one that's not divided and at each other's throats and wanting to wage war on so many different levels. Philippians chapter 2, verse 4. Philippians chapter 2, verse 4. Continuing the same theme of what we saw in Ephesians 5, it's easy to read through certain scriptures and gloss over them, but there's a profundity that is so significant as far as the love of Christ to the church. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 4. He inspired Paul to write verse 4. Or verse 3, let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than themselves. Verse 4, let not every man look on his own things, but on every man on the things of others. Let this mind be in you that is also in Jesus Christ, who being in the form of God thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation and took upon himself the form of a servant, was made in the likeness of men. And if we can extrapolate on that, God the Father and the one who became Jesus Christ, or the Logos, the God of the Old Testament, were the only beings in existence. And they had planned ahead the time would come when they would have and create human beings. And one of them, they also realized that these human beings could be prone to sin. And so the decision was made to not allow them to be like angels. As far as all indication is that they could live indefinitely. They may never die. I'm talking about angels that have become demonic and lost the enlightenment of the Spirit of God and show no interest whatsoever in changing and turning their lives around. God would not want to see the human race created and then go through the same experiences, the fallen angels. So, he made them physical. And understanding that, knowing that sin was a real strong possibility, both God the Father and the one who became Jesus Christ decided that one of them would have to die for the sins of humanity and pay the price for sin. Now, that is a supreme effort, or an example. And imagine if you were in Christ's shoes, born on this earth, knowing that you were constantly butting heads with the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and being discredited, that you knew that you would be put to death, that you knew that it was worth it, that you had to die for the sins of all these people, even those that were negative. That is quite a sacrifice. That takes vision and commitment and a determination to overlook all the distractions and to never make a mistake and to live a perfect life and to become a perfect sacrifice. That is extraordinary dedication. To avoid sin, to be able to live a righteous life, would involve just constant focus. You could not let up for a second. The human mind is such that it's hard to... I remember one person saying in a program one time, if you are able to think of a single thought for 60 seconds, you're a genius. You've got a phenomenal mind control. I could tell you to think of a swaying elephant that's eaten too many fermented apples and he's bouncing through the jungle and crashing into the banana trees and struggling to keep his balance. And then I say, okay, now don't think of the elephant for the next 60 seconds. Pretty tough. But for somebody to say, I must not sin, I've got to remember why I'm a human being on this earth, for Christ to sustain focus for 33 years, approximately, that's dedication. That's intensity. If you or I were to think, I'm going to be the perfect mate here in this family for the next 5 minutes, I will not sneeze, I will not do anything wrong, I will just do everything as well as possible, that is very demanding to do it for one's life. What I'm leading up to is that Christ did it perfectly. He had that much love. It was driven by love. And he's saying that that's the kind of dedication we're to have. That is really supreme. It is incredible. It's powerful. Women sometimes will nag when they feel they have no more influence in making the relationship better. The most natural thing in the world when you feel helpless is to complain. This is not to say that she's incorrect in maybe her assessment. Gary Smalley is a marriage psychologist and writer who has made the comment over and over again that it seems like God has given women the understanding of what a marriage manual would be. And he says every one of them that he's ever counseled just instinctively knew how the marriage should look, how it should work out. And they're the ones that are reminding the men, well, you need to spend more time here, or this isn't the way it could be. And so often that is true. But in frustration sometimes, the communication turns to carping and henpecking. And that does the opposite of what is hoped for. It will drive the man away too often. It doesn't work the way she hopes, and too often it can tear down. Not to say that she's wrong. She might be 100% right. That's the natural approach that will only get begrudging compliance. I'd like to relate the woodpecker story, talking about henpecking. This is from the New York Times about 16 years ago. It says, lovesick woodpeckers poke hole in shuttle's schedule, space shuttle at Cape Kennedy. Riddled with holes drilled by woodpeckers, the space shuttle Discovery will have to retreat to the hangar for repairs to its fuel tank insulation, forcing an indefinite postponement of the launching that has been scheduled for next week, the space agency said yesterday. Officials of the Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida, stated that the shuttle would be rolled back from its launching pad next week and may not be rescheduled to fly again until August. That would be several months later. The offending birds were identified as yellow-shafted flickers, a common woodpecker in eastern North America that displays such behavior during courtship and to proclaim its territory. Technicians counted at least six dozen holes, some as big as 4 inches wide. Some penetrated to the tank's metal wall, but caused no damage to it. At a news briefing yesterday, Al Sofke, assistant launching director at the Kennedy Center, tried to be philosophical about having one of the $2 billion spaceships built to withstand the rigors of orbital flight from blast-off to reentry, driven off its launching pad by a flock of birds with mating on their minds. That happened. So, how much henpecking must happen for us to thrive on that? None of us thrive on that. If you take a love story such as the Song of Solomon, where you have two lovers that they just can't say enough wonderful things about each other, how much henpecking do you find? Let's go to Song of Solomon, chapter 1. Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 14. It says, my beloved, Song of Solomon 1:14. My beloved is to me as a cluster of cedar in the vineyards of En-Gedi. Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have the eyes of a dove. Behold, you are fair, my beloved. Yes, pleasant. Our bed is green. And it goes on with flowery, magniloquent language all the way through. And there's this passion, and these two lovers can't wait to be together. And yes, the hormones perhaps are in full array, and they're excited. You don't read in there where he says, my beloved, you are like a cluster of pieces of cedar. You are fair, you are beautiful. But you've made the following mistakes around here. No. Now, it doesn't mean that these two are perfect. They're not perfect. But one thing is that they would die for each other. You would never belittle someone that you would die for. So how do we get to that point? We ask God for that. Help me to have the love for all people. Help me to have the love to keep your law. Help me to have the love to honor my mate. Help me to have the law to care for my family or my relatives or my brethren. Those are great things to ask for. It's not something that comes naturally. If it did, we wouldn't have the divorce rates that we have in this country. But it is possible with God. With God, all things are possible. In the Proverbs 19, I'll just refer to that. 19 verse 11, it says, the discretion of a man defers his anger. Or it could be the discretion of a woman defers her anger. It is his or her glory to pass over that transgression, to overlook flaws. The emphasis is on, what can I do for that other person? Sometimes to jumpstart that love, maybe you throw your heart over the bar and your body follows. You try it, you ask God for it, and then you ask God to make it real. And that takes guts. That's heart and core Christianity. That's where the rubber really meets the road. That's where you start to see miracles happen in relationships. In Romans chapter 12. Now here is a scripture that would apply to everybody as far as their overall Christianity. We talk about it leading through the spring holy days. It's ever present with us. Romans chapter 12 and verse 1 says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present yourselves a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is our reasonable service. We would want to do that for God. We say that at Passover. We say that we're serious. We're imperfect, but we're serious. We'll stumble. We make mistakes. What else is new? We're not perfect. But that's the goal that we want. Verse 2, and be not conformed to this world, but be you transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you might prove what's good and acceptable and perfect, the will of God. And part of the will of God is that we be, within reason, a living sacrifice. And if we're going to do that to brethren, as time and circumstances allow, we're going to want to do it to the people that are closest to us. I hope. It makes sense. It's logical. Along with that, in John 15, verse 13. I think it's something that is, for most of us, if not all of us, we have to ask for, to take our relationships to a much higher level. John 15, verse 13. Greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends, for his wife, or for her husband. We talked about things last week that women can do to make an incredible impact and impression on their husbands. Not just for Father's Day, but any time. But the emphasis today overall is, what can we do to reciprocate, to show kindness in return? And when we talk about being a sacrifice, laying down one's life, it's one thing maybe to do that physically, but to do that emotionally, spiritually, day in and day out. And if that's a challenge, it's something to ask God for. But when that commitment is made, then conversation flows much more easily. It's easier to talk about the little things, the big things, and everything in between. A great marriage is a relationship of two generous people. Generous. Generous with their time, with discretionary money after meeting obligations, other things. Generous with knowledge, wisdom, and compliments. While we're on that thought, in Proverbs 31, verse 27, Proverbs 31, in verse 27. Proverbs 31, verse 27. We're familiar with the fact that this talks about the virtues of womanhood. But there's an insert verse here that's quite fitting to the context. And it says that in verse 28, her children will arise up and call her blessed. And she gets great feedback from that. Men get their feedback from work, from a wider circle of activity as a rule. Women work through the base of the home. And so it's very, very important that they receive honor and recognition for their hard work, even if some of it's routine and mundane and could be taken for granted, which we need not do. Her children arise up and they call her blessed. And her husband also, and he praises her, maybe even publicly sometimes, if in the right context. But a generous man is going to be generous with time, money, knowledge, wisdom, compliments, emotional and physical affection. Women like both, but to them, emotional is most important. And if the emotional isn't there, then nothing else is going to be there either. But certainly, a generous person will take that into consideration. Maybe the biggest gift that a generous person can give to a wife is conversation. It is easier to share conversation when you've given your heart. Where is the marriage on the hierarchy of values? Is it leftovers, scraps from a busy schedule? We all have busy schedules, but sometimes maybe we have to schedule time to be with each other, even if it's a certain few minutes in the day in between other children activities or whatever it is. But a husband does himself an enormous favor when he loves his wife. And he receives it back. He receives it back. There are always danger signs. We've all, stumbled here and there at times. The captain of the Titanic, I'm reminded, was warned 6 times by others to change his course or slow down. To get happily married, do you search for a perfect person? No, because none exists. Some of the people, like Gary Smalley here, he was just a razor's edge from getting divorced, losing his wife. Abraham was not perfect in the Bible, yet I would think that it was easy for Sarah to call him Lord. That was a concept of respect, and it's mentioned over in 1 Peter 3 and verse 6. I'd like to turn over there, 1 Peter 3 and verse 6. James, Peter. Peter addresses the subject of marriage, and in verse 6 says, "Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, as long as you do well and are not afraid with any surprise or amazement," says in the King James. That's an interesting statement, that she was happy to call him Lord. Was that because she was willing to walk 10 steps behind him and to be subservient in some a negative context? No. It was that she felt secure. Yes, he was wealthy, her needs were taken care of, but over and above that, because he was a man of God, because he kept the commandments of God, Genesis 25:6-5, that is, that God's Spirit was alive in his life. God gives his Spirit to those that obey him, and he obviously was able to make that work so that she was responsive. She was happy. So, once you think that you have a relationship, why not? Why not have all of us want to take it to the highest level by giving our lives to the person that we are endeared to the most and strive to make all communication as positive as possible? Even in marriages where everything seems to have gone wrong, the option always exists to rebuild, to bury scorecards of wrong and work from a positive base. Words, good words, are so important. Proverbs 25 and verse 11. And when we get caught by surprise or in the heat of emotion or we get frustrated with some things, we can say things that we wish we never did. Proverbs 25 and verse 11, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. Another proverb, 15 verse 13, says similar things. 15 verse 13, a merry heart makes a cheerful countenance, but by sorrow of the heart the spirit is broken. But the first part of that, a merry heart makes a cheerful countenance, that kind of atmosphere. I should have had us keep our finger in 1 Peter 3. I want to go back to 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. You can turn there if you wish. But I'll read verse 7. It says, likewise, you husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers, our prayers, not be hindered. Now, when it says weaker vessel, that does not mean that the woman is inferior to the man any more than, say, a small 24-carat diamond is inferior to a mile-high skyscraper made out of concrete. It's not a case of one's better than the other. They're just different. What is superior, a farm horse or a racehorse? They have different purposes. They're different. What's superior, a pickup truck or a sedan? A hammer or a chisel? A vacuum cleaner or a broom? They're just different with different purposes. Now, in James Dobson's book that came out years ago, What Wives Wish Their Husbands Knew About Women, still has some valuable points that drives home. He mentions how more than men, women will get slowed down by fatigue and time pressure. Amazingly, even if successful, sometimes low self-esteem. Well, women are strong enough to survive without reassurance, but they thrive on emotional and verbal support. Loneliness, isolation, and boredom can sometimes affect women. Small children can isolate parents like that. Husbands need to occasionally get their wives out of the house. Oftentimes, husbands are the key. Again, using Christian principle. It's amazing how that is seamless, works through all of Christianity as well as marriage in particular. In Matthew chapter 20, Matthew chapter 20 and verse 25. Something that's lost in the world of male chauvinism and in many cultures. This was a revolutionary concept that Christ introduced even to his disciples. But in Matthew chapter 20 and verse 25, familiar territory, I think, to us, it says, Jesus called them to himself, and he said, you know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them, but it shall not be so among you. But whoever is great among you, whoever would be a leader, let him be your minister, your servant. And whosoever shall be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered to, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. He was dedicated, Christ was, again, to the welfare of those around him. And if we are constantly dedicated to those that are important to us, then we enhance their lives. We simply do. Men that do not want to live by that principle should not be the head of the house because it would be a farce. Husbands tend to initiate and wives tend to respond to that, and that's what works the best. Although both can initiate, and it says in Ephesians 5, verse 21, 22, that they can be in subjection to each other. The man isn't going to have the best idea all the time, nor the wife. Sometimes by sharing points of view, they are able to come up with a better informed and a better plan, a better decision. Sometimes we may give in our own way. Well, you know, She doesn't understand me, but she does the best she can. There's a couple songs by that have that theme. And it goes back and forth with men. Well, that's just his way. Well, does that meet the needs of the wife? To me, that would be like a car mechanic that's called up to go out to do a roadside repair. And the repair is because the radiator blew. And so the mechanic gets there, he checks the radiator, he says, well, lady, looks like you're lucky. The motor didn't burn up. But next thing you know, he's checking the tires, and he sees that one tire is a little low, so he puts air into that. And another one's half bald, so he changes that tire out. And he says, well, I guess, you know, I've done enough here, so have a good day, and I'll see you later. Well, the radiator's still a major problem. It would be a disaster for her to drive without that being taken care of. It's easy to fix the wrong things or to address the wrong aspect. Well, how do you know what to do? Well, this is a real profound thing. All you have to do is ask. And our wives would be very, very happy to tell us because they know what's going on. They are tuned into the family. They know. And they have this built-in manual to be able to share that. And that can lead to some constructive discussion. It says in Acts 20, verse 25, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Well, you don't have to turn there. More blessed to give than to receive. A nightmare for the relationship is if both parties live as if it is more righteous to get rather than to give. Giving is not necessarily giving up. It doesn't mean that if I have special interests or certain friends, that I have to give those up if I'm going to give to my mate. She doesn't have to give her circle up. Of acquaintances or friends or whatever to share her life with me. So if she's at the women's club for a couple of hours, I'm not going to fret about it, or vice versa. We're not supposed to be the same, and we are not. There are physical differences with men and women, and there are emotional differences between women and men. Let us not forget, in Genesis 1, verse 31, when God created his creation, including men and women and their proclivities, he stepped back, he says, and lo, it was very good. Very good. He wouldn't change it. It's this way by design. It forces us to come into the middle, to understand each other and to give to each other. I think of a time, an experiment that was run in a college, circumstances were set up and with the question, what are these people going to do? They had two rows of students, and they sat down at a table, and they hadn't eaten for a day, and they had a splint on their arm, so they could not bend. They could not feed themselves, in other words. They were sitting down at this meal, and the study was made to find out if they brought in different groups, different ages, how long would it go before they would realize that they, even though they couldn't feed each other, they could dip spoons into food and reach across the table and feed the person across from them. And they ran different experiments, and in some of the cases, the people just sat there and stared at each other. They never figured it out, never figured that they could help each other to have what they needed. And that's sometimes the way it is in marriage, where maybe the other person has the answer, the ability, and needs to bring that to the middle to share. Some of the physical differences enumerated is just the appearance, as we all know, but below the surface, they differ, men and women, in skeletal structure. Women have shorter heads, broader face, chin less protruding, shorter legs, and a longer trunk. The first finger of the woman's hand is usually longer than the third. With the men, the reverse is true. Boys' teeth last longer than those of girls. Women have larger kidneys, livers, and appendix, and smaller lungs. Women's blood contains more water, 20% fewer red cells. Because of that, she may tire more sooner than a man and may be prone to fainting. The working day in the British factory under wartime conditions increased from 10 hours to 12 hours. Accidents of women increased 150%. For women, not at all. In brute strength, men are 50% stronger than women. A woman's heart beats more rapidly, 80 times a minute versus 72 for men. Blood pressure, 10 points lower than a man, varies from minute to minute. But she has much less tendency to high blood pressure, at least until after menopause. Vital capacity or breathing power is lower than the 7 to 10 ratio. She stands high temperature better than men do. And the metabolism slows down less. Those are physical differences. The other differences, men derive self-esteem by being respected. Women usually derive it by the people that they love, that they hope love them. Men derive esteem from the outside world, women from that in the home. Men oftentimes, with some exception, are more interested in things. Women tend to be the ones more interested in people and relationships. Men tend to look for solutions to problems. Women can value talking even multiple times on problems that continue unsolved. Let me use a case in point. Let's take the example where Joe and Phil have a conversation. Joe says, "I hate my job." Phil says, "Then you should think of doing something else." Joe says, "Well, you know, that's not a bad idea." "Yeah, that's not a bad idea." Phil says, "Yes, Joe, life is too short." "Yeah, Phil, I think you're right. I'm going to turn in my notice." Makes sense. Sometimes this is a wife talking to her husband in the same way. Over dinner, after a rough day of work, the wife says, quote, "I hate my job." Man says, "Well, why don't you quit?" She says, "No, it's just that there's so much work to do and there's not enough people." "Well, then tell your boss to hire some help for you." "Oh, why can't you ever listen to me?" she asks, getting frustrated. And he genuinely looks confused. He says, "I am listening to you. If you didn't want my advice, why did you bring up the subject?" And then she is totally frustrated. Her real message is, "I want to connect with you." And sometimes in communication, it's not just the words, but it's a steady stream of consciousness that the woman has that she wants the man to lock into. The man is quick for a solution because that's how we would do it. That's how we guys are with each other. It's the same thing as far as shopping. I remember going to Home Depot with a friend. It was wonderful. We made a surgical strike. Move in, get it, move out. They didn't even know what happened. Took 2.5 minutes. We got the thing. But that could be a way of life. Oh, let's go in and dabble around and see what's going on in this department and see how these plants are doing. And which is right, which is wrong? It's not right or wrong. It's a matter of looking at life differently. If we all did things the same way, life would be boring. And it's nice if we can see things from other points of view. But we have to be willing to give up ourselves to do that. We have to. So it's not that one way is the right way. One way always and the other is inferior to it. It's just that we're different and it takes some effort to come into the middle to get into the mind of the other person. And if we're lazy, we don't do that. If we're in a hurry, we don't do that. If we're always in a hurry, we have to take time out, go somewhere, do something to recharge with each other and to be a couple. So it's important for us to always be asking ourselves, what can I do to enhance my part of the marriage? As we grow more spiritually, what more can I bring to the table? So I need to wrap this up. But we've talked about some very important points. That if they're employed, we get a totally different result than maybe we've ever dreamed of having from the past. What can we do? Husbands need to give their lives for their wives. We saw John 15 and Matthew 20 illustrate that. This facilitates the best communication. It opens up topics of conversation, one of which could be goals and aspirations. What do we want to do? Another area is being willing to praise her. If we need to take the time to take inventory, then let us do that. As well as she can take the time to inventory and say, well, you know, he can do so many things, which I appreciate. And by all means, let him know, or let her know. We have to realize, as men, our wives are not an interruption of our lives. They add color and creativity to our lives. They are happiest when they are doing that. So it's to be appreciated. God equips them to be able to do that well. What would life be like if there were no women on this earth? It'd be drab. What if there were no men? It'd be equally a mess. Need also to overlook imperfections and mistakes. Important to recognize her differences and adapt to them. Not demand in an area that she cannot give, or vice versa, but to work within our strengths and our parameters, that she knows that she will not nag him as he strives to do the things that are right, because nagging does not work. And from last week's message, she will help make his home his castle, and that ultimately will inspire him to want to make the castle her castle as well. Focusing on his needs and interests, as mentioned last time, which inspires him to more enthusiastically respond to her needs and her interest, and to move mountains if need be, to make that happen. We talked about the value of physical affection that would be modified with circumstances and age, but at least allowing time together. You know, it may, and something like this could lead to some marriage counseling. Men typically think that this is admitting failure. Frankly, it admits the opposite. It admits wisdom and strength. Occasionally, there is a need in marriage counseling to address issues of abuse, financial mismanagement, alcoholism, drug abuse, and other behavior that's beyond the scope of this message. But there's valuable information on that, and those are important considerations that have to be dealt with for those that find themselves in those circumstances, or from time to time. But in conclusion, James Dobson studies and other people continually point out that half of the marriages that we see end in divorce, and there are additional live-in relationships that crumble that never make it to an altar, and others that are not nearly as happy as they could be. He estimated maybe only 10% really have a vibrant marriage. But all of us are entitled to want a happy marriage. All of us have the ability, the potential to be able to do that. We have our part. There's a lot of good information. I choose a subject like this not because of the needs of a few people, if there are people that I'd be aware of. It is a collective need. It is so valuable for our group to be able to all be pushing to have stronger relationships everywhere we can. We have our part to play. There is information, and most importantly, the biblical principles of which we've looked at some. Let us want to have the happiest marriages that we can. This choice certainly belongs to us.